No.
May it please the court. The issue before the court today is whether a prior drug conviction under Illinois law necessarily qualifies as a drug trafficking offense, given that under Illinois' accountability statute, a person may be liable for the actions of another by merely soliciting a drug transaction. The illegal immigration guideline limits drug trafficking offenses to manufacture, import, export, distribution, and dispensing. The court has held numerous times that solicitation offenses do not fall within that definition, and this case follows similar logic. The district court considered accountability to be akin to aiding and abetting, but the Illinois statute's plain language is broader than that. It mentions not only aiding and abetting, but solicitation. And as I noted earlier, the court has never held that solicitation constitutes drug trafficking.
What did he plead guilty to?
He pled guilty to delivery and possession with intent to deliver cannabis.
If we stop there, then no issue, is there?
If you stop with the solicitation aspect of it, or?
As I understood it, the man pled guilty to distribution of cannabis and then in a very large quantity. And what you're arguing is that because Illinois has an attribution party statute, that this, we re-examine this and say, well, there is some possibility that he was guilty of that offense by attribution. And my question is, whether it's by attribution or not, he's guilty of the offense. Isn't that the, why do we want to inject another level of complexity to a matter that has already probably been made too complex by lawyers spinning this out?
Well, I understand the court's concern, but it... Well,
my concern is this. The objective of the guidelines was to respond to disparities and to get some evenness of outcomes. And what we're doing is we're spinning this into such a complex, highly speculative enterprise that no one knows the outcome. You've turned it upside down. You have a defendant here that pled guilty quite clearly on the record to an offense which quite clearly and indisputably is an offense that would of a violent within the category that we're dealing with under the Taylor-Shepard line. I admire your creativity, but I'm just telling you at the outset that there's got to be some kind of a practicality to this. Otherwise, we're going to lose sight of what the guidelines are about.
Well, Your Honor, it's not speculative in that Illinois courts have applied this accountability theory when somebody pleads guilty to what would appear to be a delivery offense or is tried on what would appear to be a delivery offense. It doesn't appear in the indictment. And even if the defendant pleads to delivery, the means by which it could be proved the delivery is not limited in the way that you suggest. We can't tell from the record.
Let me ask you this question. What difference does it make if I'm guilty of a substantive offense X as to whether I did X or whether I'm guilty of it by aiding and abetting the crime or some other theory, whether it be aiding and abetting or some other legal principle which attributes me to the liability because of my participation? The statute speaks of offense, not my, doesn't it?
The statute does criminalize delivery, but Illinois may be unique in how broad it can be, your actual participation. And the guidelines are clear. They list a set of actions which constitute drug trafficking. And beyond that, this court has held that other actions, while, you know, obviously subjecting the defendant to past criminal liability are not sufficient to be considered drug trafficking. Aiding and abetting is one of the offenses that is listed in the back. However, the way the courts have interpreted it, and if the court wishes to wade into the murky depths of accountability liability in Illinois, the court would find that little more than a proving presence is required, and that's not a drug trafficking offense. If the court would like an example, under People v. Taylor, which is 646 Northeast 2nd 567, which is a 1995 Illinois Supreme Court case, little more than a proving presence was enough to hold a man accountable for murder because he was a passenger in a car in which another passenger had said that he wanted to kill another man for having jumped his brother. The Supreme Court case states that active participation is not required for the accountability theory of liability to apply. And from the papers in this case, we can't really tell the theory on which Mr. Sandoval Ruiz pled guilty.
Well, in every one of these cases you're talking about, that you cited, it, you, what you had was an underlying statutory distinction. In other words, the attribution of liability is to a statute that's got components, some of which would not be the a felony offense that within the meaning of that we're looking for. Here you have indisputably that you pled guilty to it. And what you're saying, as I understand the argument, is that you're guilty of that unless you the fact that you are guilty because you were of attributed liability takes it out of the category. And I have a little trouble with that concept. The guidelines said that drug trafficking offense for which the sentence a conviction for a felony, you have a conviction for a felony, right? A drug for which the sentence imposed is exceeded 13 months. It's an offense under federal, state, or local law that prohibits the manufacture, import, and so forth, distribution, or the possession of a controlled substance with intent to manufacture. Now, however, if that is the offense, what difference does it make that whether you were out there driving the truck or you were counting the money back in the house?
What if it was neither of those things and you were merely approvingly present in a car while somebody else was dealing drugs? I mean, that's if you apply the logic of this Taylor case, which I just outlined, to the drug context, that's all it would be. And being approvingly present is not among those actions that you just listed in reading the guideline definition. And it's not aiding and abetting either. It's something broader than that. And we cannot tell from the pleadings, because somebody pled to delivery, that the person actually was an active participant in the delivery under Illinois law.
Well, it doesn't appear that under the Illinois law, one can be found accountable for just being present.
Approvingly present is the language that they used. I mean, I feel like this Taylor case is very instructive. Being in a car, not actually inciting or encouraging the act, but merely not disassociating from the person in the car who intended to kill another person. No active participation is required. He didn't participate in the planning or the execution. One who's present at a crime without opposing it or disapproving it can be found to share the criminal intent of the principal.
Does your argument rest on your suggestion in the brief that under Illinois law, a mere approving presence at a crime can lead a person to be accountable under Illinois law?
Not necessarily. I think the court can just stop with the solicitation language. By just comparing the act of solicitation to the actions that are listed in the definition of drug trafficking offense, the court really could just stop there, is my argument. But certainly if the court wanted to look into what constitutes accountability under Illinois law, then yes, it would require the approving presence or little more than approving presence argument that I'm making.
There's another Illinois case than the one you cite that says, and I quote, a fact finder may infer a defendant's accountability from her approving presence at the scene of the crime and that's what's been dropped, and from evidence of conduct showing a design on defendant's part to aid in the offense.
Well,
if that's so, then how does that really distinguish from the federal aid and abet statutes, which the guidelines do explicitly? Deal with?
Well, I'd be glad to answer that. The aiding and abetting, the federal definition of aiding and abetting requires active participation. The Illinois accountability statute does not, as this Taylor case that I've cited indicates. And also, those cases that I cited in my brief were more for the purpose of demonstrating that the accountability statute is not just of my imagination, that it has been applied to drug cases. Another case, if you wanted to look at a drug case in particular, is
active participation, meaning what? If I hire someone to kill someone, and I sit in the bar and wait until it's done, am I active a participant in that? And as you are using the term?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Something less than that is is all that's required under Illinois
law. You mean I just sit there and don't do anything?
You deliberately associate yourself with people who are bent on doing wrong, and you don't report the crime. Maybe you flee from the police after the fact, but your active participation either before or during the crime is not required. That under the Illinois Supreme Court.
How do you design without under your approach? How do you design? you engage from evidence of conduct. This is what the Illinois said. I'm quoting the Illinois law, showing a design on defendant's part. How do you?
The conduct can be after the fact. I guess is what I'm trying to get at. If you maintain a close association with the principal after the fact, and for example, you flee the police together. Courts have inferred that an intent to further the crime existed prior to that from acts occurring after the offense, and that would be broader than aiding and abetting, which aiding and abetting is only before the offense and during the offense, not after the offense.
This defendant wasn't charged under accountability statute. He was charged with a primary substantive offense, right?
Correct, Your Honor, but he would never be charged with accountability.
But let's just stop at that point. If we had a conviction for which he was charged, there would be no issue. Is that correct? If that's all we had.
You mean if there was no such thing as the accountability statute?
Well, never mind. Yeah.
I apologize, Your Honor.
No, you understand my question.
No, I'm not sure I do.
I think you do.
If we look at the indictment and don't look at the statute.
If you charged the substantive crime and you didn't have the element of accountability, which is what your argument relies upon, there would be no question about that conviction meeting the standards that the government contends. Is that correct?
Well, I don't think so.
Is that right or not?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because accountability would never be charged. It's not an element of the offense.
You're not listening to my question. I'm not making myself clear, I guess. I said if you take accountability, the attribution aspect of this to one side,
which it
is not charged. The man is charged with a crime. He's convicted of the crime. If we stop there, there's no question about it. What happens is that under the law of Illinois, there is an accountability feature which could have been used, perhaps, at a trial, had there been a trial. But he's pled guilty. And so what you're saying is that hypothetically, if he had gone to trial, that they could have been convicted because he was not sufficiently engaged in the not sufficiently a participant to meet Illinois standards, to meet Illinois standards, but not for purposes of the guidelines.
Yes, but the statute could still apply even with a guilty plea because we don't know what he pled to exactly, what the plea colloquy consisted of. We have the indictment, but that wouldn't be the whole story. But yes, I agree, Your Honor. If we were to just look at the statute of conviction without reference to the accountability theory of liability.
What does the record show about what was said at the plea?
We don't have that in the record at all.
We don't have anything.
No, Your Honor. And I would just...
So this means that every person who pleads to a felony where they have an attribution statute that this is not an aggravated offense or it's not a felony for these purposes.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I don't think too many accountability statutes are as broad as that of Illinois.
All right.
I would like to, in my remaining moment here, call the court's attention to People v. Newman, which is 569 Northeast 2nd, 1089. It's a 1991 Court of Appeals case where the defendant was caught during a drug raid without any drugs. He had only entered the house a little bit earlier, and he was held to be responsible for possession with intent to distribute, because the police recovered a great deal of drugs and drug paraphernalia in the house. His actual participation was not demonstrated. He just tried to flee upon the raid of the house.
Did you give that case to the government?
No. I wasn't sure that the court was interested in it. This issue wasn't really raised by the government.
It's a 1991 case, so why are you raising it right now?
Because I thought it seemed that the court was interested in an application of the accountability statute. To the possession with intent to distribute context. If the court has no further questions.
All right, thank you, Ms. Landau. You've reserved some time for rebuttal. All right, we'll hear from the government. Ms. Alanis, is that correct?
Alanis.
Alanis, I'm sorry.
May it please the court. I think this case is pretty simple. I think Taylor versus United States has laid out exactly how we need to deal with this case. The first thing we do, we look at the state statute of the underlying prior conviction. Mr. Sandoval has never alleged that that statute is overbroad on its face, looking at the language of the statute. I think our inquiry ends there. That's what Taylor says. We look at the statute. If it's not overbroad, we're done. That's it. Shepard basically amplified Taylor in cases where there, as in this one, where there has been a plea of guilty, and says that if you need to, you can look at certain documents like indictments, other charging instruments, jury instructions, and certain other things to determine whether or not.
Have any other circuits addressed the situations where the plea is to the substantive offense and not to the inchoate offense of solicitation?
I have not found any.
Has any case that you have found supported this position that's being advocated here by this defendant?
I have not. There are some cases about solicitation.
Take the flip side of that. Has any one other court addressed it?
Not that I'm aware of, not in this particular context.
Do you have any idea how many statutes such as Illinois have a statute structure such as Illinois?
I do not, Your Honor. I know that Texas is very similar. They also have that language of solicit. I don't think there's anything special about the Illinois law of accountability.
What, in your view, is the relationship of the Illinois attribution law to how does the Illinois attribution law compare to our federal aid and abettor provision?
I think it is very, very similar. The definition of solicit in Illinois is to command, authorize, urge, incite, request, or advise another to commit an offense. The federal aiding and abetting statute is
advise. So even under advise, one could not be under a counsel officer's argument an active participant. They're just a passive, borderline passive. The design, they're encouraging it, whatever.
Well, I disagree with that. I think to be found guilty as a party, you have to do more than just say something. In fact, under federal law, you have to be associated with the criminal enterprise, participate in the venture, and seek by your action to make the venture succeed.
What I'm trying to get at, the argument, as I understand it, is that the attribution rules of Illinois sweep more broadly than do the aider and abettor provisions of the Title 18.
I guess that depends on your interpretation of the word solicit. I don't think that is any.
Interpreted the word, what?
Solicit. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yes.
The Illinois law does include the word solicit. That is not in the federal aiding and abetting statute. But solicit, clearly, when you look at the definition under Illinois law, it means inducing someone else to commit the offense. It doesn't mean just being there. And
it has to be a solicitation of a form that furthers the actual offense itself. Is that
yes.
Correct?
Yes. And there is a case called People versus Hairston, which I've cited in my brief.
And this plea of guilty, as I understand it, is to the substantive offense itself, not to the inchoate offense of solicitation.
Absolutely, Your Honor. He pled guilty to two counts.
So whatever. Whatever attribution that's inherent in the word solicitation or whatever has progressed sufficiently to constitute the to meet that provision, I suppose.
I agree. He stood before the Illinois court and said, I am guilty of delivery and possession with intent to deliver.
In other words, if what I'm suggesting to you, if someone just solicits the sale of narcotics, and it ends there. There is no sale of narcotics. there is no substantive offense of distribution that has been aided and abetted.
That is correct, Your Honor, that the People v. Harrison case.
Whatever it may mean in another context, if you have a charge of distribution and you plead guilty to that, for you to have been convicted on a party's charge of that, it would have to have been conduct that was sufficient to have led to that ultimate offense itself.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the Harrison case makes that distinction. There is the offense of solicitation, which is just the words. And for solicitation, the offense itself never has to actually occur. To be convicted as a party or to be held criminally accountable for the substantive offense, the offense has to occur. And, of course, you have to do more than just be present. And I would like to address that mere approving presence issue.
My concern is not addressed to counsel and lawyers. I admire the creativity of the lawyers. They just have a rich field to work with the guidelines, I say.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree. But I would also like to say that in Shepherd, the government attempted to enlarge Taylor by saying, hey, we would like the court to be able to look at police reports and other things. And the Supreme Court was quite vehement that, no, we are going to interpret Taylor quite narrowly. We're not going to let you all look at police reports. They don't have enough reliability. And I feel like this is kind of the reverse here. The defense is trying to open up Taylor, expand it incredibly, and I think the Supreme Court said that was not a good idea in Shepherd.
You were going to briefly address, I think, the argument about mere presence being...
Oh, yes, mere presence. I disagree that mere approving presence is enough under Illinois law. I am not familiar with the Taylor case that Ms. Landau spoke of. I don't believe that was in either of her briefs, but the Martinez case, which I believe Judge Higginbotham has already mentioned, mere approving presence is merely one factor from which the fact finder can infer intent. But the whole rule is, as Judge Higginbotham pointed out, you can infer defendant's accountability from approving presence at the scene of a crime and from evidence of conduct showing a design on her part to aid in the offense. There is another case called People v. Ropo. Again, same rule. You can infer accountability, of course, intent. We're always looking for circumstantial evidence to prove up intent from approving presence and from approving presence and from evidence of conduct showing the design to aid in the offense. Just being present and not doing anything is not enough. And I also don't believe the Illinois law of accountability criminalizes conduct that occurs after the crime.
What's the position of the government as to what this rule ought to be? I mean, this is a to say the least, I've given counsel a difficult time, but it is a tricky problem. We need some kind of clarity here. The district judges have got to administer this rule, and on top of that, perhaps more important in a practical sense, the people who are putting together the PSR, so the administration of this stuff requires some kind of certainty. Otherwise, we're really turn the system upside down trying to get some clarity to it. So what's the bright line rule? What do you have us do?
I think the bright line rule is present in Taylor. We look at the elements of the statutory offense. I think we can look at other statutes defining those elements of the offense, and I don't think we need to go any further. If we go further, I think we're getting into those theoretical probability or theoretical possibilities that the Supreme Court addressed in the Duenas case, where they said you have to show more than just some theoretical possibility. I agree this is a very interesting question. It reminds me of those questions the law professors used to ask, and you didn't know what the answer was. But I don't think it is a good rule as a matter of policy, because you're right. We have to interpret these laws, and they have to be at least somewhat easily ascertainable for everyone in the process.
If we concluded that the government is correct because the offense pleaded to contain no element of solicitation, that the elements of the offense, looking to the elements of the offense to which were admitted, that's the end of the story. What cases would this cause difficulty with? Are there any cases out there that would create tension with?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand. If solicitation is an element of the offense?
No, if we just say that whatever may be, as I read the cases, the situations in which we have said that we do not have a prior conviction that is going to cause the defendant difficulty here, in situations where there has been you look at he pleads to a charged crime, and then you look at the under a statute, and then you look at the statute, and the statute has elements that can be proved in different ways, and some of those will not meet it, because there are different elements. Here, the elements are defined, and there's no solicitation in there. It is a separate, independent theory of liability that might be employed. If we stop there, I'm not sure how that fits in our case law.
Well, I just don't think there's any case law saying we need to go any farther than the elements and their definitions. I believe there's also case law, I think it's in the Ninth Circuit.
However you may be proved under the law to be guilty, if these are the elements, the conclusion is these elements have been proved, that's it.
Yes, and I think that's particularly true, as in this case where you have a plea of guilty, all we ever had was the charging instruments. Obviously, if he had gone to trial and there had been instructions for the jury, if he had been charged, or if that was the state's theory that he was a party, that would have been in those jury instructions, and the jury would have had to decide that. But I think it's just a little inherently unfair that the defendant gets the benefit of his plea bargaining in Illinois and then tries to escape the consequences on down the line just because there was some theoretical possibility.
Has the government's position been consistent in these line of cases, as far as you know? I mean, I know that there's some different treatment in some of the other circuits in terms of, you know, whether or not solicitation is a part of the statute or not. Fortunately here, this isn't a plain error case. I mean, there was an objection, so it's straight on before us. But as best you can tell, is the argument you're making in terms of looking at the elements, et cetera, is that the consistent position the government's taken in these cases?
As far as I know there is a case coming up for argument before this court next month that involves the application of the Illinois law of accountability in the context of whether a burglary can be counted under this enhancement. I don't believe I said anything different than my colleague did in that brief. It's a very different situation, of course, because burglary is not a defined offense. But that was the only other one that I'm aware of involving this case, this law.
Right.
Well, if you have no further questions, we'll just ask the court to affirm this conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Landau, you save some time for rebuttal.
I understand the court's concern about having a defined set of terms and applying those terms, but really I really feel the government is misreading Taylor in asking the court to limit the analysis in that fashion. In Duenas-Alvarez itself, the Supreme Court was looking at a court doctrine of natural and probable consequences. It wasn't even a statute. That is a much more theoretical situation than what I'm advocating here. Here we have a statute, one that would never appear in the record, and one that could provide the basis for a plea of guilty. It's not a hypothetical. Sorry.
What's the, articulate the precise holding you would want us to come out of this case with in the context of other cases that we're going to decide?
Well, the easiest way from point A to point B, as I see it, is to rely solely on the statutory text, including the accountability statute. And note that solicitation is included in the accountability statute. It is not included in the definition of
aid. No, you're giving me the argument. I said, you articulate for me what you say the holding in this case should be, given that that holding would have applicability to the numerous other cases in this genre that we get. I want you to tell me what you're saying the holding should be. The government has told us. You tell me. I know what your argument is.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Solicitation is akin, solicitation offenses such as offer to sell are beyond the definition of the drug trafficking statute. Therefore, because Illinois law criminalizes solicitation, it too is beyond the definition of a drug trafficking offense. Just put it in the same realm as Garza Lopez and as Gonzalez. That would be the holding that I could see the easiest way to get from my argument to the holding. Now, if the court wanted to peel back the lid.
Even where the defendant pleads to the substantive offense and he's never pleading to.
We don't know.
Charged with.
We don't know what he pled to, Your Honor. That's the problem. The government has the burden of demonstrating the applicability of the enhancement. And it didn't do so here. We don't have the plea colloquy. We don't know what he pled to. We know what the charge is, but we don't know what the proof is. And the proof could have been, and not a hypothetical possibility, but a realistic possibility under Duenas-Alvarez, that he pled to.
Well, practical matter, we never know what the proof is, because even if the case is tried, we don't have those records. In these cases, with these prior fictions, all you're looking at is a you know, the different lingo in the different courts, but you're looking at a sheet that shows prior convictions and with sometimes sparse information.
What about a plea colloquy? I think that could.
We're going to look at the evidence in these cases now, in a prior conviction, to see what actually was proved at trial and not what he pled. Here, there is no trial. He pleads outright to it, and you say, well, he may have pled to it. You redefine it by your theory, and right or wrong, your theory has the effect of saying that given the fact that in Illinois law they have this accountability principle of law, it's not an element of a crime, it's not charged in the indictment, it's a principle of law, that any crime that's committed, you cannot determine what the person is. It changes the content of each of the elements of the offense. And so you really can't stop with what the elements are. You've got to look and say, well, it says that he distributed here, what was it?
Cannabis.
What was the quantity of?
5,000 grams, I believe, in the indictment.
He distributed 5,000 pounds of marijuana.
Grams, Your Honor.
But we don't know, and he pled guilty to that, but under the law of Illinois, it is possible that he only solicited someone that, and so he was guilty of distributing 5,000 pounds of this because he only solicited somebody to do it. I had to confess having some problems with how they got the 5,000 distributed. When it was just the inchoate effort of solicitation that didn't go further. He just suggested it to somebody and walked off, and then somebody distributed 5,000 pounds of marijuana.
Well, maybe he was approvingly present in a car, Your Honor. I understand. I appreciate you giving me credit for creativity here, but in Duenas-Alvarez, it was much more hypothetical, and the Supreme Court not only looked at it,